evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet as we do every Sunday evening for the last 30-some-odd years since 1982. The curious radioamateurs gather at this time and share their knowledge of how radio equipment works, antennas and transmission lines, transmitters, receivers, low noise amplifiers, digital techniques, repeaters, satellites, forward propagated tropospheric scatter, all this kind of jazz. There's a large number of different kinds of ham radio, something like 26 or 27 different kinds. 2 meter ham radio by way of a repeater is just one of those kinds that you're listening to right now. Let me drop. So there's a lot more to be learned, and the people who are pretty smart at wireless equipment didn't acquire that knowledge overnight. It took some number of years of fiddling with it as a ham radio operator, building antennas, tweaking them, tuning up transmitters, optimizing receivers, adding low noise preamplifiers, and so on. So all of that experience is what the people who gather here try to share it with each other. The TechNet usually runs for 4 hours, starting at 8 o'clock and running until midnight on Sunday nights. The first hour or so is devoted to people who sign in because they do have a question or a comment. Need not sign in because you're listening. After 36 years, we believe, or 37 years, we believe somebody's listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So a typical sign-in would be AC2GS, Roy, and Yes. As you can see, you're going to give call letters, a name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. We drop. The second portion of the TechNet is where Roy, AC2GS, Dr. Roy runs the mailbag and the science talk. So he's got some interesting puzzles and questions and whatever. The third portion of the TechNet is by Paul, WS2N, which is the space report. And he tells us what NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and all the other international space agencies throughout the world, what they're doing. He brings us up to date on all that. Let me drop. So at this time, we're going to take the check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment. Please wait until you hear the beep so you don't time out the machine. Please do give me your call letters and your name. Lots of people forget to do that. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. So, do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. N2XGN.
WA2VDH, John, yes.
K2RLW, Bob, no.
WH4YY, Joe, yes.
Okay, we've picked up Wes, John, Bob with a no, and Joe. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. And maybe that's all we've got for tonight. So we'll start off with the current list. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Very simple question. The impedance is a property of the AC network. What is the impedance of 50 hertz or 60 hertz power line or power network that we use? And it's being called electrical grid. Let me drop. So you have interconnected network for delivering electricity from producers to the customers. The power station is somewhere near the fuel source, let's say dam, and we are often away in heavily populated areas. The electric power which is generated is stepped down and up, and we got the power. But that is impedance that has to be matched, or it doesn't. And why we don't care about it if we don't. That was it.
You said you thought this was a simple question. It is not simple. You could, by way of a rapid pulsing technique, do the equivalent of a vector network analyzer on your power line and find out what the surge impedance is. In other words, for a brief pulse connected to that line of known amount of current, what voltage drop would you get because of the pulse that you've added? I don't know what that number is, but it could easily be a couple of ohms, surge impedance. And therefore, you would think that if you put a load on the line, the voltage would drop significantly, and it does not. It does not because the power company really acts like a servo mechanism. Throughout the system, there's various places where the voltage is sampled. That information is fed back to the network. The network adjusts its primary voltage accordingly to keep the voltage at the consumer nearly constant. So that the net result is that you can add a particular heavy load to your 120-volt line, and it might drop down to 119 volts. And most of the drop is probably taking place within the wiring inside your house. Because of the pole peak transformer at your house, that drops the impedance down to a very nice low number. So the voltage coming out of that transformer varies very little as a function of load. But an awful lot of that lack of variation is the servo mechanism attempting to keep the voltage constant. That's part of the answer I think you're looking for. N2XJN, K2RW.
So what is the impedance of the power grid?
There's more than one impedance. There's a surge impedance that I mentioned earlier, which could be some number of ohms. There is the equivalent impedance because of the servo mechanism, which is very close to zero. Because of that servo mechanism, where it's trying very hard to maintain the voltage constant at your house, the equivalent impedance is a fraction of an ohm, in my opinion. Over to you, Wes.
Are we dealing with series or parallel resonance in power lines from point A to point B?
See, in the case of a transmitter feeding signals through a transmission line to an antenna, there the most desirable situation is to match the impedance. 50-ohm transmission line. In the ideal world, the transmitter would have a 50-ohm output, and the antenna would have a 50-ohm input. And one of the techniques that's often used to measure the impedance is called the half-voltage method. You put no load on an unknown source of a signal and measure the voltage, open circuit voltage. You then start loading it down until that voltage drops down to one-half. If, for instance, I took a pure 50-ohm source, which I could generate by taking my signal generator, which is never very close to 50 ohms of output, put it through a 20 decibel attenuator, a 50 ohm attenuator, the output impedance would be very, very close to 50 ohms out of that attenuator. If I then measured the open circuit voltage and put a 50 ohm load on it, I would find that the voltage goes down to one half. We, of course, would never want to do that with powering the things in your house. The open circuit voltage at your house might be 120 volts, and when you turn on all the appliances in your house, you'd like the voltage to not drop down any further than, say, 119. That's not a matched impedance. By way of this servo mechanism, they're attempting to make the electronic impedance as close to 0 ohms equivalent at your house. In other words, you start loading it down to measure what voltage drop you get, and under ideal conditions, it's going to be very little. So, there's no simple definition of the impedance of that power line, but it's far from an impedance match. They're trying their darndest to make it as close to 0 ohms equivalent impedance as possible. Into XJN, K2RW.
The one way, though, to have the impedance to zero is when XL cancels XC. But then, it is strictly related to series resonance in series resonance circuit. So capacitive reactance cancel inductive reactance, and we have zero. But at that point, we have a maximum of current and minimum of voltage. And with power resonance circuit, we will have reverse situation. So how can you get the impedance close to zero in our domestic power line?
You're considering it a reactive circuit. That's not the way the power company considers it. The major component of their impedance is pure resistive ohms of the wiring, of the windings of the transformer, of the leakage reactance between primary and secondary of the transformer, and the resistance of the wiring that goes all the way back to the power station on the, we'll say the 13.2 kilovolt distribution system. The majority of the impedance you get on that grid is a pure resistor. They do not attempt to resonate it at 60 hertz. There's a certain amount of inductance in that wire. There's a certain amount of distributed capacitance. As a surge impedance, it's got a certain impedance. If you put brief pulses on that wire, you might measure an apparent surge impedance of some large number of ohms. But that's not what you see under working conditions. Because of that servo mechanism, and they know they're getting voltage drop to the majority of their resistance, they adjust the voltage accordingly at the source to make sure that you're getting very close to 120 volts at your house. So it's not a reactive circuit. It's not a resonant circuit, in my opinion. Over to you, Wes, K2IW.
Are you telling me that we cannot put 60 hertz or 50 hertz on the Smith chart?
I certainly didn't say that. You're saying that the grid is a circuit that's got inductance and capacitance. It does. You're saying that that equals a resonance at 60 hertz. It does not. It is not resonant at 60 hertz. Without a doubt, there's distributed inductance and distributed capacitance in that wiring. It is not resonant at 60 hertz, even though you think that's what you want. Over to US K2IW.
So, a transformer cannot exist without reactive components of impedance. How then you are able to simply compensate those reactive components, so you're dealing with the purely resistive component? My understanding is that if you have only resistance, you don't have electricity in AC form, because DC is the only way that you can have no reactive components. And to exist.
I didn't say there's no reactance component. I'm just saying that the reactance is not dominant. It's not something that you have to really worry about. In the case of a well-designed transformer, running at, say, 120 volts going into it, and maybe 6.3 volts coming out of the secondary winding. You want the inductance of the primary winding to be large enough so that the current flowing into that primary winding is very low when there is no load. And if the transformer is well designed, there is a very tight coupling between that primary winding and the secondary winding. There's very little leakage reactance between the two. But that 6.3 volt filament transformer that you might use to run the filaments of your vacuum tubes on the old-fashioned tube-type radio, it is not resonant at 60 hertz. If the transformer is well-designed, the inductance of the primary winding is large enough to create a great enough inductive reactance so that it represents very little current flowing when there's no load on the transformer. The current that flows to the primary, you want 98% of that current to be only the current required to feed current out of the secondary winding. Don't resonate a filament transformer. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Do you agree that the lower the frequency, the lower the losses? Interesting.
No, don't agree with that at all. Most military aircraft run on 400 hertz. At 60 hertz, because At 400 hertz, they need much less iron in the transformer. That lightens the transformers. And weight on an aircraft is something that's very important. So they think the system is much more efficient at 400 hertz instead of 60 hertz or 50 hertz. So it depends on how you're applying the design. If weight is your criteria, then the higher the frequency, the better. Many high voltage inverter circuits run at 100 kilohertz, which drastically lightens the transformer. And if it's a well-designed circuit, it can give you a very well-regulated output voltage, DC or AC, by various techniques, by switching techniques, by pulse width modulation. It can generate a 60 hertz wave, even though the inverter itself is running at 100 KC, with 100 KC going through the transformer. Over to you, SK2RIW.
That's very interesting. I knew about it, but thank you for reminding that. So, 400 hertz, lower gauge of the wire, and much lighter is the transformer or the circuitry that is using the approximate current. But then, don't we deal with the skin effect?
Yes, but at 60 hertz or at 400 hertz, the skin effect is quite different than it would be at, say, 30 megahertz. When you look at the formula for skin effect, it's a it's a square root function, 1 over square root of 1 over frequency. So as the frequency gets higher, the skin depth gets smaller and smaller. You only run into skin depth definition problems at 60 hertz when you're looking at a very large chunk of wire, like a double O piece of wire. When it comes to a piece of 14-gauge wire going through your house at 60 hertz, the current through the center of that wire and the current through the perimeter of that wire is very close to the same. That skin effect goes through almost all of the diameter of that 14-gauge wire. Over to you, SK2RIW.
So then the ratio for 400 hertz would be 400 divided by 60, and that would determine the gauge of the wire?
I told you it is a square root function. 60 divided into 400, take the square root of that, that's the difference in skin effect of 400 hertz versus 60 hertz. So it's not as big a ratio as you would think, but still, and by the way, you said at 400 hertz the wiring can be lighter. Not true. If I'm running 120 volts at 400 hertz, or I'm running 120 volts at 60 hertz, depending on what current I want out of it, I'm going to be using very close to the same gauge of wire in both cases. Over to SK2RIW.
So in terms of efficiency, what is the gain? What is the deal that we're getting at 400 hertz versus 60?
The main thing you're getting is much lighter transformers. Various transformers are required. You've got an alternator back at the jet engine. That's the primary source of the energy that's flowing through the aircraft. You have various transformers throughout the power supplies that are stepping up and stepping down the voltage for transmitters and receivers. So the main reason that 400 hertz is used on an aircraft is to drastically lighten the amount of iron that's required in the transformers, to lighten those transformers. That's the main thing they gain by it. Also, the number of turns required in the primary and secondary of the transformer gets less as the frequency goes higher, because it's the primary inductance that measures and the amount of iron you're using that determines the number of turns that are got to be in that primary winding. And then after that is the turns ratio, depending on what voltage you want. So you save on wire in the transformer, you save on iron in the transformer when you go to 400 hertz. That, in my opinion, is the major driving function for 400 hertz being used on military aircraft. K2RIW, over to you, Wes.
I wonder how many electricians on this TechNet were ever taught about the impedance in power at bridge. And I would risk the statement, none. There is no information on the whole internet about impedance as a factor for the power grid. What is your response, Dick?
I agree. Impedance is something you and I talk about a lot when it comes to matching impedance, going into amplifiers and coming out of transmitters and going into field transmission lines and going into antennas. There, we match impedance, and the word impedance is important. When you're talking about a power grid and a distribution system and a transmission system for electronic energy to run houses and factories and whatever, impedance is not the factor. The majority of what you and I would call impedance in that situation is ohmic resistance of the wiring and the length of the wire. So they care about what voltage drop they're going to get for what gauge of wire and how many miles or feet of that wire. So it's not impedance at all. No electrician uses anything that looks like a vector network analyzer or an antenna analyzer. That's instrumentation that we RF people use to measure impedance. They don't measure impedance. They don't care about it. It's not the important factor. It's ohmic voltage drop of the resistance of the wiring is the main thing they care about. OVUS K2IW.
And now I'm going to tell you why did I ask you that question. There is an apple of literature in the internet and also some of the articles written by Dr. James Corum. And it comes to one point. The lower the frequency, the lower the losses. And some of the articles compare the losses to the Schumann frequencies. At Schumann resonances, the losses, the closer you are to primary 7.8 hertz Schumann frequency, the lower the losses. Isn't that 60 hertz or 50 hertz was chosen instead of 400 hertz, 1 kilohertz on 10 kilohertz, and 2 XGN?
Okay, when you talk about Schumann, I think you're trying to use the ionosphere as the upper plate and the Earth's surface as the lower plate of a piece of waveguide through air where you're transmitting energy wirelessly like Tesla was trying to do. Is that what you're talking about with the Schumann technique? Wes, go ahead.
Not at all. The thing is that what you, that you're telling me is one of the things that is related to Schumann resonance. The Schumann resonance is the resonance between ionosphere and the air because we're dealing with the waveguide. So then we have a standing wave, and then we have a certain frequency that wave is resonating at. But it was found in a number of articles that the closer to Schumann frequency, the lower the losses of the power distribution as well. My question is it anything that is, forget about the Schumann, I just mentioned it, is it, why did we use 60 hertz, not 10 kilohertz? Why did we use 50 hertz? Why we didn't go lower or higher? And to XGN.
I suspect that now we're talking about the way you wind and turn a generator or alternator. Let's talk about generator. An AC generator is going to have a certain amount of iron, a certain number of turns of wire on that iron, and you're going to spin that armature at a certain speed. 50 hertz or 60 hertz turns out to be a rather desirable frequency when it comes to the way you wind that generator and the way you turn it. If I was going to run that generator, a very large multi-kilowatt or megawatt generator, at 400 hertz, I'd have to use much thinner laminations on the iron that's in that generator so as not to get eddy currents. You're going to be continuously getting eddy current losses. And the eddy current losses go up rapidly with frequency. So that makes you go to a lower frequency. But if you go to too low a frequency, you can't get enough inductance of the wiring without going to a very large number of turns. So 50 hertz or 60 hertz is a kind of a middle compromise for the way you generate, the way you mechanically engineer and construct that alternating or that AC generator. backed at the power station. That's how I think they settled on those frequencies, Wes. It's got nothing to do with the ionosphere. Inter-XJN, K2IW.
I completely agree with you. It has nothing to do with ionosphere. It is. It was just found that the lower you go with the frequency, the lower the losses are. I was trying to find the number of articles standing about the losses at low frequencies, and not many of them say about it, but one of the claims of Dr. Corum is that if he sends the electricity from point A to point B, in his technology using the interface, he is able to get the losses of 6 to 2%, that means, no, I'm sorry, 8. So that would be 92 to 98% efficiency. Enter a share.
Well, you were saying that the lower the frequency, the lower the loss. The lowest frequency in the world is DC. Edison thought that the power should be transmitted by DC, and he set up a circuit in New York City to do that. And it had some huge disadvantages, which you probably know about. So, in that particular case, the lowest frequency in the world, DC, is terrible. ODUS.
Yes, you're right. But this is not the frequency. It's a zero frequency, it's no frequency, it's DC. It's one way from point A to B, power transfer. With AC, you have alternating current. And it always goes through zero. Now, if you look at the high power tube that we're using in our amplifiers, we had, and you look at it when you put the power on it, and when you talk to the microphone, in the interface, between that what you're talking, what you're saying, you see that the tube is getting hotter or is getting cooler. Now, when you have the AC sinusoidal, it goes always to zero. So if we're talking about the losses on the wire, on the heat of the wire, when it goes to zero, then the heat is none, addition to the heat. Do you agree with that?
Every AC signal has an equivalent RMS, root mean square. The 120 volts that you and I use, 115 volts in our house, really hits 167 volts peak. It has an RMS value of 120. It goes through zero, but it goes to a high voltage twice on every cycle. The big war between Westinghouse and Edison, AC versus DC, the advantage that Westinghouse had is that with AC, you can transmit power through a long distance with very little voltage drop if you raise the voltage to a very high voltage at a very low current for the same amount of energy. Because the current is low, the ohmic resistance of the wiring becomes less of a problem. And you step the voltage back down with a transformer that's near the actual load situation. So Edison was running, just to go down a couple of blocks in New York City, his DC voltage was such that the light bulbs at the end of the block were running dim, where the light bulbs at the beginning of the block were too bright because of voltage drop. DC gives you that problem. But when you're transmitting power over long distances and you're doing it at 13 kilovolts or half a megavolt, very high voltage, very low current, all of a sudden the resistance of the wiring becomes much less of a problem, and you can always adjust the voltage any way you want with the right kind of a transformer near the load. So Westinghouse was right, and Edison had to give up. He lost that particular battle. Over to you, Wes, K2IW.
Thank you very much for this explanation. If at the end of that, would you like to touch the blackout situation and the causes of it, just for curiosity, I would appreciate that. Thank you very much. Great answer, and thank you for your time.
Now, I'm going to skip over the blackout situation for now. We're going to go to the next person. And we've got some time left over at the end. We'll consider going back to it. John, to B2VDH. Go right ahead with your question or comment, John. K2IW listening.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Thanks. Say good evening to everybody on the net. My question has to do with forward power, reflected power, and gas re-reflected power, and some questions how it sort of contradicts with superposition. But the example I'm going to use, I'm going to use a generator, which is 20 volts RMS in series with a 50 ohm resistance as an internal resistance. So this generator it has an available power of 2 watts, because when I put a 50 ohm resistor across it, I get 10 volts, and 10 squared over 50 is 2 watts. So I'm going to hook it up to one wavelength of line terminated in 50 ohms. Okay, let me just pause, see if there's any questions on that.
No, I'm picturing the circuit that you're drawing, so go right ahead, John.
Okay, good, fine business. Okay, so this generator, with its internal resistance of 50 ohms and 20 volts, is hooked up to one wavelength of line terminated in 50 ohms. So in this case, the SWR is 1:1. The voltage that's developed at the terminals where the generator hooks up is 10 volts. The forward voltage is 10 volts. The reflected voltage, of course, is 0 because we have a perfect match. And the forward power is 10 squared over 50, which is 2 watts, which all goes to the load. Okay, that's case one, a perfect match. Okay, here's case two. The same generator, 20 volts in series with a 50 ohm resistor, hooked up to one wavelength of line, but now we're terminated in 500 ohms. Okay, so this is case two. We're terminated in 500 ohms. So in this case, I think the SWR is 10:1. The reflection coefficient, if you do 500 minus 50 over 500 plus 50, is something like 0.818. Okay, so now this generator develops at the line terminals. It's going to develop 18.18 volts. Okay, because it sees 500 ohms at the end of the one wavelength line. That's twice around the Smith chart, and it develops and it sees 500 ohms. So the voltage across there is a total voltage of 18.18, which I get by voltage dividing 500 over 550 times 20, which gives me 18.18. Okay, let me drop. Okay, so now I'm going to resolve that 18.18 volts into a forward voltage and a reflected voltage. Okay, so I say 18.18 equals V forward plus V reflected. So next line, 18.18 equals V forward plus gamma in times V forward. Okay, so I factor out the V forward and I get that the 18.18 is V forward times 1 plus gamma in, and the gamma in is 0.818. So when I do the division and bring it over and divide, I get a V forward of 10 volts, and when I multiply by gamma in, I get a V reflected of 8.18 volts. Okay, let me just stop now, see if there's any questions on that.
I think I see where you're going, and I think you're about to try to calculate, after the reflected voltage comes back to the signal generator, how much of it gets re-reflected forward is what I think you're about to go through. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Well, in this case, I don't think anything gets re-reflected forward, because looking back into the generator, we see 50 ohms. So looking into the generator, we have a match. But since the total voltage that appears at those terminals is 18.18 volts, and we have a forward voltage of 10 volts, a reflected voltage of 8.18 volts, when those two voltages constructively add, we get our Vmax, which occurs at the load, at the generator, and at the half wavelength point on the line. We get a Vmin, if I'm working this out right, a quarter wave and three quarters a wave from the load, and that's when the two voltages destructively interfere, which gives me, I think, 1.82 volts. Okay, now what's interesting is right across that internal resistance of the generator, since 18.18 volts total is appearing at those terminals, I'm getting 1.82 volts across the internal resistance of that generator. So next I'm going to say a few words about power, but let me just stop and see if any questions on that.
And I think your 500 watt load is absorbing 0.66 watts, where it used to absorb 2 watts. Over to you, John.
Exactly, yes. The load is dissipating 662 milliwatts, because when you work out the forward power, 10 squared over 50 is 2 watts, the reflected power, 8.18 squared over 50, is 1.338 watts. So, yes, the difference of those, which you can do in the forward direction there, is 662 milliwatts. That's the load power. Now, here's where it gets a little sticky. The internal resistance of the generator there has 1.82 volts across it. 1.82 volts across 50 ohms gives me 66 milliwatts dissipated in the generator resistance. We have a reflected power of 1.338 watts. Where does that go? This is somewhat rhetorical, and we'll see in a second. Go ahead.
Okay. When the 50-ohm load was there, you had a given amount of voltage and current coming out of the generator after its 50-ohm resistor. When you put a 500-ohm load, the current coming out of the generator is definitely lower. The generator generated less energy to the outside world of that generator when the higher load was there. The extreme case is when if the 500-ohm resistor became an open circuit, the generator would be generating no energy at all. So you generate less power with a higher load applied to your line. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
But the thing I wanted to note is that, yeah, if it had been an open circuit, then the full 20 volts would have appeared there as VS, and our forward voltage would have been 10, our reflected voltage would have been 10, that would have added to 20 at the terminals. At the quarter wave points, we would have gotten zero voltage because they would have destructively interfered. And, of course, across the open circuit, we would have the full 20 volts. But, you see, in that case, the forward power would be 2 watts, and the reflected power would be 2 watts. You see, the point where this is going is that we can't superpose power going back to the generator, okay? In the forward direction, we can take the difference in the forward and reflected power and get the load power. But working back towards the generator, it doesn't work. And this becomes more interesting when we do a reactive load, which in the interest of time, I might let go to next week. But that whole thing about where does that 1.338 watts go? You see, we can't superpose it when looking around the generator, because internally we only see the generator's resistance dissipating something like 66 milliwatts. Go ahead.
Let me go back to that extreme case. Your transmission line is a half wavelength long. You've put an open circuit on the output of the transmission line. The magic about a half wavelength of transmission line is whatever the output impedance is, the input impedance will be the same if the line is lossless. So therefore, you've got an open circuit, infinite impedance on the output. The generator looking into that half wavelength long of transmission line sees an open circuit. It draws no current. So in that case, although the voltages add and subtract in funny ways at the quarter wave and half wave points, the generator is generating no energy. is generating 20 volts at zero current because it sees an open circuit. So when you try to talk about forward power and reverse power, when the generator is generating no power, we've got a conflict here of terms. Over to you, John, KGRIW.
Yes, I agree. We have a conflict of terms, and the conflict comes from trying to superpose power. Actually, the line was one wavelength long, but the half one half wave works just as well. So in that case where the line is open circuited and it's a half wavelength long, what are the forward and reflected voltages on that line? Go ahead.
You're generating no power. You do see 20 volts at the generator, and you see 20 volts at the input of the line. And in the middle of the line, you'll see 0 volts. And let me think about that now. Yeah, I think you'll see 0 volts at the quarter wave point. Quarter wave from the generator, a quarter wave from the open circuit, you'll see 0 volts. So voltage is being generated, it's going down the line, but no significant current is flowing at the input end of that transmission line and the output end of the transmission line. There will be some current at the quarter wave points, but again, there'll be no voltage there. So again, there is no energy. So defining the amount of power becomes crazy. I think this is one of those situations where if you make believe that Mother Nature always thinks in volts and amps, she does not think in watts. We can talk about the voltages and the currents that are flowing at the eighth wave point. You got some reactive energy flowing, so to speak. So we can talk about the voltages and the currents in various places along the transmission line. But if we try to transmit things, try to calculate things in watts with an open circuit, I think you're going to come up with some pretty crazy answers at times, John. Go ahead. KQYW.
WY2U.
Okay, here's a man. Mike's got to straighten this all out. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and good evening, all. Well, I'm certainly going to try. First of all, I forget the other fellow's name, but he's quite right. Superposition does not work. And very simply, superposition only works for linear circuits. Linear voltage, linear current, linear impedance, whatever. Power is not linear. Since it's voltage or current squared, superposition will not work. So he's right about that. Let me drop a second. And now, when it comes to power, the way you're describing it, I think what he's talking about, forward power and reflected power, are figures of merit and not necessarily, like you said it before, having to do anything with Mother Nature. For the case when he has a 500-ohm load, let's put it right at the generator. Forget the fact that you got any transmission line at all. Just take the 500-ohm load, stick it on the back end of a signal generator whose output impedance is 50 ohms. The generator is not generating 2 watts as it was before. It's generating 20 volts divided by, 20 volts squared divided by 550 ohms, a far cry from 2 watts. Now, if you extend that away, either a half a wavelength or a wavelength, and you put a sensing device in the line that measures power going one way and power going the other way only, you're quite correct. You're going to measure what appears to be 2 watts of power and 6 tenths of a watt of power. When you try to add them up, it doesn't add up. But keep in mind that forward power and reflected power is not true power that is being generated by the generator itself, as you pointed out before. I think I said that right. Let's see if that makes sense. Back to net, WY2U.
Let's see what John says about all that. You got it, John. You're the guy who asked the original question.
Oh, yeah, yes, I totally agree. I see, we're going back towards the generator, we're trying to superpose power. We're trying to superpose generator power coming out with reflected power. And that's where it breaks down. In the forward direction, going towards the load, when I'm back with my one wavelength of line and the 500-ohm resistor at the end of the line there, I can take the difference between the forward power and the reflected power, that is, the forward power being 2 watts, the reflected power being the what was it though? The 8.18 squared over 50, that is the reflected power of 1.338 watts. The difference of that is the 662 milliwatts that the load is absorbing. And to get to your case, Dick, the extreme case with the open circuit there, if you stuck a buried watt meter in that line, you would see a forward power of 2 watts and a reflective power of 2 watts. Okay, but we cannot use those reflected powers to try to see what the generator is putting out. And my other example with a reactive load, it makes it even more extreme. You see, it's that you can't superpose the powers going back towards the generator because you essentially have two sources. Go ahead.
WBTZSC.
And by the way, if you put a bird watt meter in there with an open circuit, because the voltage coming out of the generator will double, the bird watt meter is not going to see 2 watts. It's going to see something much greater than that. The new person joining us, please repeat your call letters and your name and then proceed with your comment. K2LIW.
WBTZSC. I've only got a few minutes, Dick, but good evening.
Mr. ZSC, start off with your name and then make your comment, sir.
Name is Steve, and has anybody taken into account the phase differential between the forward and reflected power?
What Professor Cosmo was telling us, Mike, WY2U, is that, he knows his call letters, I've forgotten them already. You can calculate forward and reverse voltages and currents. And now, in a case when you've got a mismatched system, and you start boiling that down into wattage, because wattage is a function of voltage squared over the impedance, you run into a nonlinearity. You can easily get yourself in trouble. Mother Nature thinks in volts, or Mother Nature thinks in current. So amps and volts, you could add everything up and subtract everything in voltage and current and come up with the right answers. You start calculating forward and reverse wattage here. In most cases, I think you're going to get in trouble. That's what I think Mike was telling us, and that's what I think John has already experienced. I don't know who wants to speak next. K2LIW.
WY2U, I have a very simple example maybe for John.
You got it, Mike.
Okay, John, try this, if you would. Just take a generator, power supply, battery, whatever, and put two unequal resistors in parallel. How you want to do it. Now, put a resistor in series and put a resistor in parallel. You're going to make a voltage divider of some kind. And then calculate the currents and voltages. And if you want, you could use two sources, too. Have maybe a T-type of circuit where you've got two resistances going to two separate batteries and where the two resistors are, and disconnect the two resistors together and put another branch resistor to ground. So you make a T-connection out of three resistors. Let me drop. So you got two batteries, three resistors. Do superposition. Turn down one source and calculate the voltage and current with respect to the other source. Calculate the power dissipated in each resistor when you're doing that. Now, it's simple to do. And then do the same thing, but turn down the first source and calculate the voltages and currents that are due to the second source, just like you did before, and calculate the power. You will find out that current and voltage add like they're supposed to, power does not. And again, the reason why power does not in a simple circuit like that is because power is a nonlinear quantity in either voltage or current. And if you want to apply the rules of superposition, superposition only applies to a linear circuit. Did I make myself clear on that, Dick or John? Back to you, Dick, first. WY2U.
Yeah, if you use superposition with reference to voltages or superposition with reference to currents, I think you'll come up with the right answer. You try to use superposition with powers, you're going to get in trouble. I think I'm restating slightly differently the way you just did, Mike. Back to you, Mike.
perfectly fine, just the way you said it. And John can work that out if he wants. Again, you know, three resistors, they don't have to be equal. They can be arbitrary values. Two separate batteries, they can be arbitrary values. Just apply superposition for voltage or current. Everything is hunky-dory. When you try to add the powers in the branches, it won't work at all. And again, the reason for that is because power is nonlinear. Back to net.
You got it, John.
Very good. Yes, fine business. Yes, I agree 110%. Here's a quick example. A 3-volt generator, 3 volts at 0 degrees, a 4-volt generator, 4 volts RMS at 0 degrees, apply to a 10-ohm resistor. If you take the 3-volt generator all by itself, you get 3 squared over 10, 9-tenths of a watt. The 4-volt generator all by itself, you get 4 squared over 10, 1.6 watts. But the two of them together, 3 and 4 is 7, gives you 7 squared over 10, that's 4.9 watts. So, yeah, I totally agree with that. I think there are two exceptions to that. One of them is when the voltages are in quadrature, such as what happens in a hybrid combiner, and when the voltages are at different frequencies. For example, if you do that same 3-volt, 4-volt thing, make one of the generators 3 volts at 0 and the other 4 volts at 90 degrees, you will see what, by Pythagoras' theorem, it works out. You can superpose the two generators and add the powers. But as I say, that's the one of the special cases, and the other one, of course, is at different frequencies, like with Fourier series. So what all of this is adding up to is that statement of when we have a matching device about the power being re-reflected. And I think just in the interest of time and fairness to others, I'll let that part go to next week. But I just wanted to establish this, that we cannot superpose these powers when we're doing working towards a generator. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure if whether or not you were the guy that we had a somewhat similar discussion on this subject a year or two ago. One of the things that I've often said is that you listen to the guys on 20 meters, a fair percentage of them believe that an antenna tuner takes all the reflected power from a mismatched antenna and transmission line, all that reflected power, and throws it away. I say absolutely not. If you've got a high-quality antenna tuner matchbox, and you properly set it, it takes all of that reflected power and re-reflects it forward in phase with the power that's now being generated by your transmitter. And if the feed line is low enough in loss, ultimately all that power is radiated by your antenna as if it was perfectly impedance matched. So a well-designed antenna tuner is made out of lossless components, so it doesn't, everything runs ice cold. It's a well-shielded box, so that it's not radiating any energy. So your transmitter will see a perfect 50-ohm load. It's generating 100 watts. The antenna might be reflecting some ridiculous percentage of that, but because of the way the energy is bouncing back and forth between the output end of your antenna tuner and the antenna, if the transmission line is low enough in loss, it all gets ultimately radiated. But you now try to calculate what's happening to the reflected power. I know for a fact the answer is the antenna tuner does not waste any energy. It does re-reflect it forward in phase. But because the real energy is bouncing back and forth multiple times, this is a kind of an infinite series type calculation. The mathematics you have to use to make it come out right at first is very spooky. I wonder if you run into that problem, Mike. WY2U, K2RIW?
The answer is yes. And the way you do that, I guess one way to do that is just iteratively, calculate power flow as it goes back and forth per cycle. Eventually what happens is steady state is approached, and then you sum up all the answers, and then it works out correct. But otherwise, if you put a very large mismatch on the end of a transmission line and have the energy back and forth, travel back and forth several times, the first trip up will give you a ridiculous result, and not until maybe 7 or 8 trips later do you start seeing convergence, and then the results start to make sense. Back to net.
Once you realize the problem really is an infinite series, there is a mathematical technique by which you can take those thousands of bounces and boil it down into one slightly different equation. There's a way of taking an infinite series and solving that equation so that you get the right answer in one step. Now, I bet you it's possible to apply that to this case, Mike. What do you think, K2RIW?
I believe you're talking about Maclaurin series, and I've seen that done. I've never done it myself, but I think that might work. Is that what you're referring to?
You got it. I'm not sure that that's the right name, but I think you've got it. So there's a way of taking an infinite series and boiling it down to a modified equation that gives you the ultimate answer after a zillion bounces. The average guy really does it with adding up all those individual bounces, and it's a rather nasty problem. Unless you set it up as a four next loop in a computer program, you can set the four next loop to go through 50 iterations, and it'll come up with the right answer. So where things really get crazy is there was a puzzle that was put into the QEX issue about 3 or 4 years ago, in which you've got two separate signal generators on opposite ends of a transmission line. And the signal generators are set at different power levels, both on the same frequency, but different phase angles. And you now try to calculate how much energy is flowing where. And it gets pretty crazy. So that's the situation you're getting yourself into here, John. W82VDH, K2RIW, be careful.
Okay, well, as Bill Shakespeare would say, there's the rub. My point is that statement of the antenna tuner re-reflecting the power is exactly the problem that we want to avoid, because that very statement means that we are superposing with power. I didn't want to get into it tonight, but I'd like to bring it up again next week, where I use a load of 50 plus J150, which makes a horrendous SWR. And I think I did this once before, but then a half wave away, I stick a minus J150 as my antenna tuner. So you see, now looking into that, on the other side of that capacitor, I see 50 plus J0. I see 50 ohms. So my generator is going to deliver its full available power to that load. But to say that the power is totally re-reflected by that capacitor can't be, because looking in there now, you see 50 minus J150, which is not a magnitude 1 reflection coefficient. The only thing that can totally re-reflect power is a magnitude 1 reflection coefficient, which means an open circuit, a short circuit, or pure reactance. And as I said, I didn't want to take the time to get into tonight, but I'd like to discuss that a little bit more next week in terms of this whole thing about re-reflection of power. Just to wrap things up, I just want to mention that there's an article in the QEX magazine. Just let me drop it. There's an article in the 2001 issue of QEX magazine, the January, February, the June, July, and the November, December issue of 2001 QEX, a series of three articles by VE9SRB, Victor Echo 9, Susan Romeo Baker, Stephen Best. He goes into this whole detail about re-reflection of power by an antenna tuner, and show that it is a commonly held a misconception that the total re-reflection of power occurs. Because as he says, that can only happen with a magnitude 1 reflection coefficient. Go ahead.
By that simple method of analysis, you could come to that conclusion. It's not the right answer. Many of us have put a bird wattmeter at the input end of an antenna tuner, and when it's properly set up, you see 100 watts flowing forward and 0 watts coming back. The bird wattmeter at the input end says everything's hunky-dory. You've got a fairly mismatched antenna, and the output end, you're going to see the bird wattmeter will show greater than 100 watts flowing forward. And the average person says, well, that's reactive power. It's not real. I think it's real. You could put a directional coupler on there and sample some of that 150 watts going forward, and you would get a sample that's proportional to 150 watts, and you could light a light bulb with it. It's real. And so because this is an infinite series situation where there's a large number of bounces going back and forth between the output end of that antenna tuner and the antenna, light